Nancy, once again, thank you very much, and thank you to everybody who made it out for the makeup session. Everyone again has the sheets that say Rachel the Thief at the top. Okay. Originally, this was titled Rachel the Dreamer. There's a lot that you can do with Rachel's career. But the more I looked around and the more I thought about it, I decided this is really where I wanted to go with it. Last time, we dealt with the question of Rebecca's deception and do we view her as an outgrowth of her family, her parents from Aram, Laban, Lavan, Betuel, that group, or do we view her as part of the Abraham and Sarah line? Do we view the deception as something that was done because, you know, she's of those who do that sort of thing, who deceive for self-interest, or do we view her as having done this selflessly because this was what was right? Today we're going to look at another deception, and really, it's going to lead us to the major question of how we look at our ancestors who stole. And there's no doubt, there is deception and theft throughout the story of our ancestors. I brought you on the sheet under number one, 14 different examples of theft and deception in the story of Jacob and Esau. Right? You can see it there. Esau deceives Isaac to gain his favor. We talked about that briefly last time. Isaac and Rebekah deceive Abimelech regarding their relationship. Yes, it's to save Isaac's life, but they tell him that they're not husband and wife. Rebekah and Jacob deceive Isaac to switch the blessing to Jacob. That was yesterday. Esau deceives Isaac regarding his desire to kill Jacob. He says, let me wait. Once the days of grief for my father, the days of mourning for my father are over, then I'm going to kill my brother. Rebekah deceives Isaac regarding sending Jacob away to save his life. She doesn't say, send him away to save his life. She says, send him away because I don't want him to marry a local girl. Let him go away and marry a girl from the family in Aram. Sorry?
No, I don't know if you don't tell the whole truth, only part of it, or if this is deceiving.
If you do it to me, it's deceiving. If I do it to somebody else, it might not be. But no, I think that.
She just did not say anything. So
it may be a lesser degree of falsehood, but any time that you are hiding something you know to be true, I think that is, you know, fundamentally deceitful. There are reasons to deceive. I'm not saying all deceit is bad. We have traditions about deceit that is considered not only permissible, but obligatory. Yeah, there are all sorts of cases. And I'll give you a practical example. It comes up for people, unfortunately, frequently. Somebody is very elderly and they're in the hospital and a close relative of theirs passes away. Do we tell them? So often the answer is no. You know, it depends to a certain extent on the relationship, their health, you know, and what they would have wanted and so on. But often we don't say something to them because we don't want to weaken their condition. We are helping them by not saying something. And when they ask us, so where is so-and-so, we find some other excuse for what to say.
Yeah, but when you say this evening, it means l'shaker?
Pachot l'yoter. L'shaker means to lie. So the answer is there is sheker by omission and there is sheker by this isn't even about a white lie. You're pointing out that she didn't say something untrue. She doesn't want Isaac marrying local girls. However, that's not really the imperative of the moment. Yes.
But my recollection is that deception is called dinevat dat, and there's the theft of the mind.
Yes.
And so even if it's not deception, it's theft still within the overall theme of thievery.
Correct. It is. And it's often very subtle. So, for example, to point out, you know, as Shana points out, we do call deception gnevat dat, stealing one's mind, which usually is taken to mean causing someone to believe something that's not true. So, for example, if I know that there is somebody who I have invited over for a Pesach Seder, I've invited their family for years, and they always say no, and I know they're going to say no again, but I want that goodwill that comes from them thinking I really was going to prepare to have their family over for the Seder. So I'm going to go invite them again, knowing full well it's never going to happen. So they might surprise you that I'm in trouble. But the point is, it's not right for me to create a false image of what's going on. Now, there are times when it is good to keep invite. I'm not saying don't invite them. Invite them. But make sure that it's for the right reason and not to deceive them. But let's go further, because there's so much here in terms of this. Laban is going to deceive Jacob in marrying off Leah to him instead of Rachel. Rachel is going to deceive Laban by taking his trafim, which is what we're going to talk about today. So we'll talk about what trafim are. Jacob deceives Laban by running away without telling him, right? In order to save himself. He's afraid that he is that Laban is out to hurt him, or Laban's family is out to hurt him, and so they run away without saying anything. We'll talk about that as well. Then, when they come back into the land of Canaan, on their way back to see Isaac, they encounter Esau. The encounter is surprisingly friendly, and the result of that is that Esau says to him, hey, let's travel together. And Jacob says, well, I can't really travel together. There's a lot of cattle. There are little kids. You go ahead, and eventually I'll meet you in Seir. Now, there are those who explain that he actually meant, eventually we will meet up in Seir, as in the time of Mashiach. There will be an ultimate accounting. There are various explanations, but one simple read of the text, which many commentators adopt, is that he was saying, you go ahead, sure, I'll meet you eventually over there, having no intention whatsoever of meeting him there. And then, of course, we get into the stories of Jacob's sons. Right? In the city of Shechem, when Dinah is taken captive, Dinah is raped in Shechem, Simon and Levi come up with a deception, telling them to circumcise themselves, to render themselves vulnerable, so that they'll be able to attack them. Then they sell Joseph. There's that little, incident involving some degree of deception, right? As they don't tell him what happened. They tell him that he was attacked by an animal. Then we get an interlude with Judah and Tamar, which really requires its own discussion, not for anywhere near right now. But Tamar deceives Judah regarding her identity. She is his daughter-in-law, and she hides that information. And then Joseph in Egypt. So Potiphar's wife makes an advance at Joseph, and then she pretends that that wasn't what happened. She pretends Joseph attacked her. And then finally, Joseph, when the brothers come down, deceives the brothers and then his father regarding his identity, pretending to be the viceroy of Egypt, not in fact their son and brother. Deception upon deception upon deception, story after story after story. And the question fundamentally is, as Ruchama started us on, when is it justified and when is it not? Yes?
A different variation of Ruchama's question is, if you are doing some deception, for the sake of a mitzvah or for the sake of heaven,
yeah,
as Tamar was doing,
right?
Then, how do you say this? Do you get a clean ticket from the charge of
Yehudah? Right. Oh, that's part of the question, and it's a very good question. It's one thing to say this is justified. But saying it's justified, does that mean what I did is something that really shouldn't be done, however, I won't get punished for it? Or do we say, no, this was actually what I was supposed to do. This is a mitzvah. As a matter of fact, there's a commentary by the classic commentator Ritva, Rabbi Yom Tov Elasvili, writing in Spain in the 13th century, regarding the issue of lies which the Talmud says are justified, such as lying for peace. He says it's not called lying at all. It's not viewed as lying. It's viewed as, this is what you're supposed to be doing. This is the recommended practice. Shana, you were going to say?
I was going to say, I'm thinking about Rambam's attitude towards repeated behavior. Wouldn't he worry that if you lie for a good reason, you'll come to lie for a bad reason because you are susceptible to lying?
Quite possibly. It's a concern.
So even if there's no punishment, there's a deterioration of your character.
Right, but life is like that. Meaning, there are good behaviors which are close to bad behaviors. And a person is just expected to know where to draw the line. And yes, that can be very difficult. So if you have people who are very forthcoming in their affection for others, there is a potential for them to extend that inappropriately. And that's something that, today, in terms of the law, we have all the various cases of harassment and so forth, in which you have people who have forgotten where the lines are. So, yes, it's a concern. I don't have anything in particular from the Rambam on this, but yes, it's it absolutely is a concern.
But there's also another question. Let's say they're blessing that the
So Ruchama raises an interesting question, which I was ducking, which is, was this blessing really Jacob's blessing to begin with? Because if you remember the incident earlier in the saga, we find that Esav comes in from the field and he's been out hunting and he's exhausted and he wants the soup that Jacob has prepared. And Jacob says, sure, just sell me your birthright. And Esav says, deal. And he does this sale, and the pasuk says, the Torah says, "Vayivez Esav et habechora." He degraded this birthright. However, the commentators note that the word used there regarding what Jacob bought is bechora, the birthright, the right of the firstborn, literally. Whereas the wording that is used in this story with Isaac and what he wants to do is bracha, the blessing. And they suggest that the blessing is not necessarily tied into the birthright. The birthright is, the firstborn received a double share. And that was a classic idea, the firstborn will receive a double share, which made sense, because the firstborn was responsible for the welfare of the family, was the one who was supposed to take care of them after the father was gone, and so he received a double portion. But that's separate from the blessing of the family line. And the way you know that is from the previous generation. Because who was Abraham's firstborn son?
Ishmael.
But who does he give the blessing to? Isaac. So it's not odd to separate those two. The argument is made by some that Jacob had a right to this. It was from that original sale. But the language indicates that it's not so clear cut. So let's look at Rachel and figure out what's going on. So once again, go back to the family line. I want to make sure we're all clear on who is whom in this story. Abraham and Sarah marry Nahor. I'm sorry, that was close. Abraham and Nahor marry Sarah and Milcah, two brothers marrying two sisters. Abraham and Sarah have the son Isaac, who marries Rebekah. Rebekah is Nahor and Milcah's granddaughter. There's that generation in between because Abraham and Sarah are much older when they finally have Isaac. So Isaac marries his first cousin once removed. Isaac and Rebekah have two sons, twins, Esav and Jacob. And Jacob is going to marry Leah and Rachel, who are Laban's daughters. So what that means is, just in terms of how this works, Jacob is going to marry his second cousin once removed.
His first cousin?
No, second cousin once removed.
Laban is his uncle.
Laban is his...
his mother's brother, right?
Lavan is his... oh, because I'm looking at it from the original relationship. You're right. It's both. It's both. That's the trick. Right? Because Jacob is... this is like my worst memories of going over family trees. Jacob's grandfather's brother is Nahor. Right?
Right.
So therefore, Nahor's son Betuel is his first cousin once removed.
Right.
No. No, I'm sorry. Is his... no. No. That's not so. Let's do it differently. Isaac and Betuel are first cousins. That we can agree on. Okay. That means Jacob and Betuel are first cousins once removed. Which means that Jacob and Laban are second cousins. If you go back to Nahor. And therefore, his daughters are his second cousin once removed. However, what Diane is pointing out is that because Jacob's mother is Rebekah, right, and Rebekah's brother Laban is then his uncle, therefore Rachel is also going to be his first cousin. That is correct. He is marrying somebody who is his first cousin as well as his second cousin once removed. That was all clear.
Does it have a sense now?
Sorry. Yes, Nancy.
These are not any of the relations that will later be prohibited.
Correct.
But this is all okay.
This is all okay.
The Torah doesn't touch it yet, but it will be okay later too.
It will be okay later too. We will hit a relationship that is illegal later, but we're not there yet. Okay? Right now, all relationships that we are mentioning here are legal in the eyes of the Torah, both before Sinai, after Sinai, for Jews, for non-Jews, doesn't make a difference. So, Rachel and Leah. Leah is the older sister. Rachel is the younger sister. We are introduced to Rachel in Genesis chapter 29 as a shepherdess. She comes out to the well. I'm skipping the whole story of her and Leah to a certain extent. In other words, I can't really skip it. We're going to get involved with it. But the story of how she got married to Jacob, we're going to have to come back to. But we're going to start from Genesis chapter 31, which is when they decide to leave the house. Okay? When they decide it's time to leave Laban. So I'm going to give you a digest of what has happened, and then we're going to go from there. So Jacob said, I want to marry Rachel. Laban said, sure, work for me for 7 years, and then you will be able to marry Rachel. He works for him for 7 years. And as the biblical text says, in his eyes is just like a bunch of days. Yamim achadim. He is so in love with her that 7 years go by in an instant. He's so excited. He's going to get married to Rachel. And then what happens? It's in the morning. He finds out, actually, the woman you married, that's her sister. That's Leah. He comes back to Laban and he says, excuse me, but, you know, that wasn't the deal. And the response that he gets from Laban is, well, you know, we don't give away the older one before the younger one here, but the younger one before the older one here. So here's what you do. Complete the week, and then you can marry the other one, Rachel, and work for me for another 7 years. That's the deal. That's what he offers him. Now here we get to what is indeed a prohibited relationship biblically, where the Torah says you're not allowed to marry two sisters while the other one is alive. In other words, if the man is married to her and then she dies, he's then able to marry her sister, but not while they're alive. But this is before the giving of the Torah, and therefore it's not considered illegal. There's some discussion about this in various biblical commentators. But the point is that he says to him, okay, now you can marry her a week later. Parenthetically, what Jewish practice do we get from that waiting of a week? Sheva brachot. Right? The practice of waiting 7 days and saying this week is dedicated to gladdening his wife. That practice comes from this, that he says, wait a week. We are going to talk about this story more, but it's going to be in next Wednesday's topic under Leah the Hated. So I'm not spending a lot of time on it now. We are going to come back to this. They're now together for 14, or Jacob has been in the house for 14 years. He has a bunch of kids. He says, you know, it's really time, you know, for me to go off on my own. And Laban says, you know, you've been such a good worker for me. What are your terms? And he says, the terms are this. Whichever of your sheep produce sheep with funny colors, striped, spotted, speckled, those are the ones, the spotted, speckled ones, those are the ones that will be for me. They seem to be the minority, the ones you wouldn't expect. The white ones, like Lavan, those are going to be for you. And lo and behold, through a series of machinations that we're not going to go into now because I barely understand it myself, he ends up getting all the sheep. Jacob hears Laban and his crew mumbling about him. This isn't right. He got all of the property. How did this happen? And he says, I think it's time to get out of Dodge. And so he says, I want to go. It's time for us to go. As I mentioned yesterday, he meets with Rachel and Leah and asks them, what do you want to do? They say, whatever you say, our father has treated us terribly. Let's go. Let's get out of town. And God says to him, I'm going to protect you and so forth. And so they run away. Laban eventually notices that they are gone. Laban notices that they're gone, and he pursues them. And when he catches up to them, the night before, God appears to him and says to him, don't harm Jacob. And that brings us to the meeting that we're going to find here. But first, take a look at number 2. Number 2 is the key verse for our discussion. I brought it in the Hebrew and in the English. This is as they're packing up to go. V'lavan alach l'gzoz es tzono. Laban went to shear his sheep. V'tignov Rachel es hatrafim asher le'avia. And Rachel stole the trafim belonging to her father. Now, what are trafim? We're going to come back to what trafim are. Maybe. We'll have to see. We have to discuss it. But what I want to show you first is the text is not ambiguous in the verb it uses for what she did. It doesn't say, Vatikach, she took. It says, Vatignov, she stole. Okay, so we know what we're talking about. Now let's see what happens as Rachel plays hide and seek. Laban says to Jacob in source number 3, what have you done? You have stolen, same word, vatignov, you have stolen my heart, and you have led my daughters as if they were prisoners of war. Why did you hide to run and steal from me? And you did not tell me. I would have sent you with joy and song, with drums and lyres. Lyres indeed. And you did not let me kiss my sons and daughters. You have acted foolishly. I have the power in my hand to harm you. But the God of your fathers told me last night, be careful not to speak to Jacob, either good or bad. And now you have gone because you longed for your father's house. Why did you steal my gods? He calls the Trafim gods. That's where we first find the idea that Trafim are idols, although I want to come back to what they are. But he calls them gods. He says, Elohai. And Jacob replied, and he said to Laban, because I feared, I said that you might steal your daughters from me. With whomsoever you find your gods, he will not live. Opposite our brothers, identify what of yours is with me and take it for yourself. If you can find it anywhere, go ahead. I don't have any. And Jacob doesn't know. He's completely unaware, the text says. And Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them. And Laban entered the tent of Jacob, the tent of Leah, the tent of the two maids, and he did not find. And he left the tent of Leah, and he entered the tent of Rachel. Now, as we read this speech that Laban gave here in number 3, right, remember his personality. This is a man who is all about greed. We saw it when they gave away Rebekah originally and he wanted to try to bargain after having originally agreed. And we saw it when he came out to meet the servant. We see it regarding switching the brides. He got 7 years out of him. That wasn't enough. Now he's going to get another 7 years for giving him the bride he didn't ask for in the first place.
But he's the epitome of deviant behavior.
Well, devious anyway.
Yeah.
Let's not overplay our evidence. But it also comes up in terms of Jacob's salary. Because as you read the text, you find that he keeps switching the terms. Jacob says, first he said, this will be my salary. Then he said, this will be my salary. Then he said, this would be my salary. He kept on changing it all along. And remember also that Jacob has felt all along he was in danger. That's why he fled in the first place. So Laban, Laban, comes out and says, I'm the good guy. I've been the good one. You're dishonest. You stole away from me. You took away my grandchildren. You don't, you don't write. You don't call. No, Laban, as far as Laban is concerned, he is the wrong party. And I've long felt that when I read these stories that Laban actually believes this. He genuinely believes that he's the good guy. Because we all know people like this. Right? If you don't, you're fortunate. But generally speaking, there are people who will do the worst things, but they're convinced in their justifications, I am a good guy, I am in fact in the right, and everybody else has harmed me. And there's a remarkable speech after this in the biblical text. I didn't bring it because I couldn't justify it. It didn't really fit with anything else. But it's magnificent, and it's worth reading. After this incident, and after he goes hunting for the Trafim, and he can't find them, Jacob rounds on him, and he delivers this fantastic rant. Really, there's no other word for it besides rant, in which he talks about how he has worked for him for 20 years, night and day, cold and heat, no matter what. He has taken care of everything and gotten nothing out of it and been abused, you know, all along. He switched his wife. He switched the salaries. And it's this magnificent speech in which Jacob returns tenfold what Laban has said here. But this is a story of theft. And whatever Laban's wrongdoings are, the bottom line is Rachel took his gods. Right? That's what he called them. He called them gods. So what exactly are teraphim? It's a very strange word. It's not clear at all. So first of all, take a look at source number 4, because I just realized that I should have read that too. I broke it out from number 3 because I wanted to show you the Hebrew, because it's going to become relevant. But V'Rachel lakcha et ha-teraphim. Rachel had taken the teraphim. Vatesimem bechar agamal, and she placed them in the pillow of the camel. Vateshev alehem, and she sat on them. Vaymashesh lavan es kol ha'ohel v'lo matzah. Laban felt the entire tent; he didn't find. Vatomer elavia, she said to her father, Al yichar beinei adoni, may my master not be angry. Kilocha lakumi panecha, I can't get up in front of you. Ki derech nashim li, the way of women is with me. I'm sorry, it's that time, I can't do it. Vayechabes, and he searched. V'lo matzah ha-teraphim, and he didn't find the teraphim. So keep this in mind, because this is going to be critical as we read the Midrash that we're going to get to. But flip to the other side. It looks like the sheets are reversed, so it's there. So in terms of what exactly these teraphim are, I brought you a couple of verses that give us some indication. The word teraphim shows up at various times in the prophets. One of them is source number 5. It's associated there with an idol made by a man named Micha. And the verse says, and the man Micha had a house of God, lowercase g, it's idolatry, and he made an ephod and teraphim, and he appointed one of his sons as his priest. Now, what is an ephod?
Breastplate.
Well, it's a breastplate slash tunic, right, of some kind. The Kohen Gadol, or the Kohanim in general, the priests in the Mishkan, in the temple, wear them. The Kohanim wear an ephod. It is associated with worship and the regalia of priesthood. And somehow, teraphim are associated with it, too. And in many verses in the prophets, we find them associated similarly with either sorcery or idolatry. Samuel 1, chapter 15, verse 23. Kings 2, chapter 23, sentence 24. Ezekiel, Yechezkel, chapter 21, sentence 26. Hosea, chapter 3, sentence 4. Zechariah, chapter 10, sentence 2. Over and over again, they're associated with idolatry or sorcery. Take a look now at number 6, though, which adds an element. This is from the story of King David when he is a fugitive from King Saul. At one point, King David marries Saul's daughter, Michal. But Saul is plotting. He's going to marry off his daughter to King David, and then he's going to raid the house in the morning and have King David taken away, killed, whatever he's planning on doing to him. David and Michal become aware. He flees. But look what they did. And Michal took the teraphim and placed them in the bed. And she placed the goatskin at his head, and she covered it with a garment. Right? Goatskin so it'll have hair. Right? So it'll look like somebody is actually sleeping in the bed. And here, teraphim are understood to be something with a human form, some kind of mannequin. Not necessarily idolatrous, because if it was idolatrous, why would it be in the house of Michal, daughter of King Saul, and, you know, the future King David? So what we're saying here is it's some kind of human-shaped form that is frequently used in idol worship.
What do we use in the Midrash of Abraham?
When it says that Abraham breaks the idols of his father Terach, I don't believe it uses the term teraphim. I think it's more psilim there. I'd have to go back and take a look, but I think it's pesel. Yeah.
It kind of sounds like seraphim. Is there any connection?
That's funny. The idea of teraphim and seraphim, but I don't think so because seraphim is with a letter sin, which isn't really to be confused with the taf that's for teraphim. I think they're different words. However, I wouldn't put it past something, there being some you know, deeper connection. That's interesting. I hadn't thought about that at all. Thank you. If you take a look at source number 7, you find the attempt of Rabbi Avram ibn Ezra to meld together the different uses of teraphim found biblically. Rabbi Avram ibn Ezra, writing in Spain in the 11th century, says the following regarding the teraphim that Rachel took. Some say these were copper implements used to determine the units of hours. Right? Before you had clocks. So somehow this was set up as some kind of a sundial thing. For all I know. Others say that astrologers can create forms which will speak at set times. They have powers they can channel. They cite the verse that Trafim will speak corruption, which is one of the verses that I referenced before. That's Zechariah chapter 10, sentence 2, in which Trafim are in the context of idolatry. But Ibn Ezra says that isn't what the sentence means, though. It seems to me that Trafim are human forms created to receive celestial forces in a way I cannot explain. Somehow people believed that these could channel forces, and that's what Laban, that's what Laban believed, which is why he calls them gods. I don't think like a golem. I think this is simply a form of idolatry in which they create human-esque forms, and they believe that somehow they will be visited by the gods. Whatever you want. It's a doll, right? I would view it more as a doll. Proof to this explanation of Trafim, bless you, is in the Trafim that Michal bat Shaul, Michal daughter of Saul, placed in the bed such that the guards thought they were the body of David. So he says, see, it's got to be some kind of humanesque form. And yes, it would be used in the service of various gods, but it isn't inherently about gods at all. It's a mannequin. So that's what we're talking about, and that's what Rachel took. So now we have a bigger problem, right? Our first problem with Rachel was the theft. Now what's our problem?
We're not supposed to have this.
Well, forget deceitful. What? Oh, well, we know how she hit them. She sat on them. I mean, I guess they're not very large, right? I mean, that would be my answer. He had the travel version. Because remember, he was... Yeah.
If it looked like a human form, it had to be... She had to add to it or something.
Maybe.
But she's lying to cover up.
Yeah, but what else is wrong here? Shayna, help me.
Why did she take them?
Yeah! Right, why is she taking idols? Does this not bother us? Aside from the theft, how about what she chose to steal? I mean, you're stealing idols? Really? Revenge on her father by stealing them? That's an interesting idea. Yes?
Maybe she meant to throw them out.
Meant to throw them out ultimately? Could be. Yeah?
It's very interesting. My daughter, I'm visiting from California. My daughter married a Torontoan who's in Chabad. They love Chabad. And I brought this up to him, which was a mistake, but anyway. But what he said was, she stole them to destroy them. Same thing.
Right. Stole them in order to destroy them.
It makes no sense to me.
Because?
Because then why didn't she destroy them? Why did she have them and hide them? Destroy them, bury them, get rid of them.
Well, that could be. I mean, without saying yes or no on that explanation, it could be that it's not safe to do anything to dispose of them while there. They're now running away, and her thought is, you know, I'll ditch them by the side of the road somewhere. It could be.
How can we admire this woman who's one of the four matriarchs if she believes in and follows idolatry?
Right.
She didn't grow up in Abraham's house. She didn't come up with Sarai's
sins. We don't know what they really are, so it's hard to tell why she took them.
Well,
it's just difficult to know why she took them. If we knew, there's all kinds of theories. If it's an idol, it's one thing. If it's something else, it's another thing. So there's so many...
Well, it's very clear, though, from Lavan's speech, it's very clear that they are idolatry associated. He calls them his gods. Now, the word god doesn't have to mean god. It could also mean a powerful entity. The term he uses in the Hebrew is Elohai, which could be a term for my powerful entities, but either way, it's associated with some level of worship. I think that's true. Mordechai, you were saying?
But she didn't grow up in Abraham's house. She didn't come under the influence of his monotheistic revelations. This is a transition generation.
So it's an interesting idea. Maybe this is an influence. But if so, then I have a problem on a different front, which is not only did she marry Jacob, but, you know, they're producing children. Those children are growing up with her as their mother and with her remaining with idolatry. This is a very difficult pill to swallow. This whole idea is very difficult. So that's one of the suggestions, is maybe she just wants her father not to own them. I have a problem with that also, which is, what's going to happen next? let's pretend she got away with it. Okay, which, I mean, she did. But let's say she takes them out of the house, she burns them somewhere, and they're all gone. What is Lavan's next move? Yeah, go back to the idol store. Like, what is this going to accomplish? Yes?
Since we don't know what trophies are, could they not, on a very simplistic level, just be a gold-covered doll? And to Lavan, they're a god. People in those days did play the gold-covered colored statues.
Okay.
To Rachel, she says, boy, this thing is worth a lot of money. I'm going to take it because it's worth a lot of money. My father ripped this off.
Oh, boy. I'm going into business. Let's say the most valuable thing that Dad has, and we'll pawn it when we get somewhere. There's an idea. Yes?
Maybe it's not another table, and maybe it's another way of worshiping God. And we know the women to live in the a way of asking God. But we have many places in the Bible that leaders asked kind of astrology. What does the Kohavim say? What does the
Well, the problem is that we're not allowed to do that. Like, the astrology is explicitly prohibited for us. But in terms of the broader question of maybe this could be used in Jewish worship, I would need some evidence for something to link this. And saying ephod, when ephod is used specifically with idolatry later on, doesn't necessarily help me, especially because there's no ephod here. Here we just have the trephim. In our story, it's just the Trephim. That, the reference was from Pesel Micha in Shoftim. Yeah?
I think it's your translation, back to Genesis number 3.
Yeah.
Whosoever you find your gods, he will not live.
Yeah.
So that's your, I think you, I'm not sure what the translation is, but you call the gods, or somebody called the gods.
Yeah, because that's the word that's used in the Hebrew.
So, at some point, Jacob thought, and realized he was referring to gods. Laban, he knew that Laban was referring to something, his gods.
Well, he knew it from the previous, because he said himself, you have stolen, where was it? My God. Why did you steal my gods?
So Jacob knew it, then Rachel
should have. Oh, Rachel definitely knows what she's taken. I think Rachel has to know. She grew up in the house. She knows what these are.
And then they're gods.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's go, let's think this through a little bit, because a couple of things haven't yet been pointed out, although we've all had good ideas, including Diane's idea of, you know, selling them. But if you're going to tell me her motivation is that she wants to worship them, that she believes in their power in some sense, and that, you know, she grew up in that house, and that she hasn't yet become, so to speak, part of the Jewish people, I have two problems. Problem number one is that it's not consistent with her identity in general in Tanakh. But problem number two is, how did she hide them?
She sat on them.
If you really believe in these as, you know, gods, it's hard to think that she sat on them. That's not really what you do with gods. The leading suggestions that I would really have, I think, are either that she wants to sell them, but that's awkward, to say the least, especially because of the way the story plays out. Or she wants her father not to have them. She is stealing them to get them out of the house. Now, there is another possibility, which I vaguely remember seeing somewhere, but again, I don't believe it because of the same thing that I said before. Maybe she believes that they have some kind of power and she doesn't want her father to figure out where they've gone. In other words, take his idols and he won't be able to figure out where Jacob and his family have gone. He would use them to try to figure, in the same way that later on in the game with Joseph's goblet, he puts it in Binyamin's sack and accuses Binyamin of having stolen it, and he says, don't you know that I use Nihush, I read omens and such, and therefore I can figure things out. Maybe the thought is that that he won't figure out where they went. But again, the problem is, if she really believes they have power, she doesn't treat them that way. But it's an interesting thought.
Rabbi,
yeah?
I just think the important thing here is that it was important to Levant. If we know that it's important, we don't know why, except exactly, but it was important, so that motivated her to do that, whether it was revenge or not. We know it's important.
Right. So you could look at it and say maybe the reason for not wanting them in the house is some form of lashing out at this father who's been so abusive all along. It's a potential point. We're going to come back to, in a second, why she would have done it in terms of getting it out of the house. But, Stephen.
It's very interesting, the whole discussion. I don't believe any of it at all. The simple fact is when you take something, it's because you want, not because you, in almost every case, not because you want to sell it. And you've got to remember this is a transitional period. Of only the third generation since her husband's grandfather said, forget about these idols, they have no significance, no power. So she wanted because they were pretty, they were tchotchkes. We all have tchotchkes. And that's the only reason that she wanted. Everything else is surmising as a guess.
I think that's also surmising as a guess. I'm sorry, people have all sorts of reasons for why they take things. I would not necessarily, I hear you, but I would not necessarily agree. So let's take a look at what the Midrash does to try to help us out here. After all this discussion, the Midrash is fairly brief. Source number 8. I'm actually bringing us multiple Midrashim, but let's see what they give us. First one that we look at, source number 8. Vatignov Rachel et hatrafim asher li'aviha. That's just the verse. She stole the trafim, her father's trafim. Vehi lo nitkavna el l'shem shamayim. She intended it only for the sake of... Sorry? She intended it only for the sake of heaven. Amra, she said, Ma ana mezil li v'nishbo kadei nesava b'kil kulei. She said, am I going to go and abandon this old man to his downfall? Notice that's in our second one in a row where we've seen the old man, right? Rebecca refers to Isaac as the old man, and now Rachel refers to her father Lavan, Laban, as the old man. So am I going to go leave him to his downfall? Therefore, the text needed to say, and Rachel stole the trafim belonging to her father. Now, what is this midrash getting this from? There are two clues. One is scriptural, and the other is big picture. The big picture one is another midrash, but it's one that's popular and has even been mentioned here this morning. The other one is a clue within the verse itself. Not so much. So, the one that's big picture takes us back to Abraham. We mentioned before, I think Diane was the one who mentioned it before, right? Abraham breaks his father's idols. Why does he break his father's idols as recorded in the Midrash?
So his father won't sin.
To try to convince his father of the falsehood of idolatry. He says, right, remember the whole thing? He makes a play out of it. He says, this idol destroyed that idol. In order to get his father there and say, what are you talking about? These idols can't do anything. Which gets him to say, hello. It's the son who is breaking away from idolatry and trying to drag his father away from idolatry. And here you go, two generations later, it is Rachel, or three, it depends on how you count the generations, but it's Rachel now breaking away from idolatry and trying to wean her father from it as well. So it's the Midrash looking at this theme of children trying to wean their parents from idolatry and making Rachel a new Abraham. That's one. That's the big picture. But second is what it picks up from the verse itself, which is found here in the Midrash. I also had brought it originally back in number 2, and I was wondering whether anyone was going to call me on it. You know what the biblical text loves? And it makes translation difficult. The biblical text loves pronouns. Over and over again, you will find biblical verses that say, he said to him, or he went to her, and it can become very difficult to figure out who the he is. Very difficult to sort out the pronouns. But here, it has a chance at a pronoun, and it doesn't do it. Sentence in source number 2, it was also quoted in the Midrash. V'lavan alach ligzoz es tzono, and Laban went to shear his sheep. V'tignov Rachel et hatrafim asher lo, it should have said. It should have said, Laban went to shear his sheep and Rachel stole his trafim. That's the normal way to say things biblically. You do the pronoun. It's filled with it to the point of frustration. Here it's not. It says Rachel stole the trafim belonging to her father. Why does it underscore that he is her father? Says the Midrash. Because that's why she took them. She took them because he is her father, and therefore she wants to help him. Ah, but he's just going to go back to the idol store? Doesn't matter. Now, you could theorize that also there could be quirks in idolatry of those days, and really he was about those idols, and he wouldn't have just wanted to get another, I don't know. But the point is not what would have happened next, as much as her saying, this is my dad. I want to save him from idolatry, and that's, from my perspective and what I'm really, you know, wanting to get at here, is what the Midrash is trying to teach me. The Midrash is seizing upon quirks in the wording, like the fact that it says her father instead of him, to try to explain to me that Rachel is good. That yes, she commits deception, but she's doing it for the highest of purposes because she wants to wean her father from idolatry. And the proof that this is the Midrash's perspective comes in the next Midrash, in source number 9. Even though not all Midrashim will agree with each other, and that's an understatement, I believe that we are following a theme here. Take a look at number 9. Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan has a different take on what happened when Lavan searched the tent. We assumed that what happened was, he searched the tent, she said, I can't get up, it's that time, I'm not able to get up, and he said, oh, okay, fine. And he just looked around the rest of the tent. But take a look at this. Rabbi Yochanan said, Trafim lo matzah. He didn't find trafim. Kitoniyot matzah. He found pitchers. Nasu trafim kitoniyot shelo levayesh et Rachel. The trafim were transformed into pitchers so as not to embarrass Rachel. Excuse me. Where did you see that happen? What verse said that?
It doesn't say that.
Yeah, it does. You have to read more carefully. Go back now, please, to source number 4, where I specifically brought you the Hebrew as well. And tell me where it hints at that. Mm-hmm. It's there. No camel.
Mm.
By the way, I just noticed a mistake. In number 4, it says Genesis 26, 34, 35. That's a mistake. It should say 31, 34, 35. That was my mistake. But they just changed 26 to 31. That's all. But it's a quirk, but it's definitely there. Take a look at the first sentence and the second sentence and what it says he didn't find. Close. The first sentence in this source, in the Hebrew, and as I translated it carefully in the English, says, Rachel took the trafim, she put them in the pillow of the camel, and she sat on them. And Laban felt the entire tent and did not find. Stops there. Did not find. Then it says, she told her father, look, I can't get up. And he searched and did not find the trafim. So I have two problems here. What are my two problems with this verse?
He didn't go to the camel.
No, what are the two problems with this verse? Number one, yes, Shana.
It seems as if he's searching twice.
Yeah, he searched already in the first verse, right? Vayimashesh lavan et kol ha'ohav v'lo matzah. He searched through the entire tent, and he didn't find. But then it says, once again, she says, I can't get up, and it says, Vayichabes, and he searched. He searched twice. That's number one. And number two? Number two is that the first verse ends, and he didn't find. The second verse says he didn't find the trophim, suggesting that in the second search, he did find something, just not trophim. The rabbis have the most remarkable ear for language. They're sitting there slaving over every word and every letter and asking, why, what happened here? And so they point out, they point out that he searches twice, and on the second search, he finds something, just not trophim. What was it that he found? It must be they were transformed into something else. What could it be? I don't know, picture sounds good. But it wasn't trophim. And by the way, the other thing, just a second, the other piece of this to keep in mind is that once again, this fits a greater theme. Remember Sarah and Pharaoh? God intervening supernaturally to save Sarah from Pharaoh and then from Avimelech? God is now going to intervene to save Rachel from Laban. It's the same intervention. Yes?
So you're implying that if it was transformed, it was transformed between the first and the second search.
Yeah. God says, uh-oh, he's looking more, I better do something. And he saves her. It's a very, first of all, I love this because it really highlights the way that they pay attention to everything within the text. And it's the sort of thing you could totally miss. I read this for I don't know how many years and never realized that he looked twice. But he did. It's explicit that he's looking twice. Why is he looking twice?
Good imagination.
Rabbi, then how do we reconcile that she was sitting on him? Or was she?
So the answer would be, she said to him, you know, I can't really get up now. And he said, get up. The answer is that he was not the respectful person that he sounded like when we first read it. Because it says, she said, I can't get up. And then he looked anyway. That's the way that this text would then read. Yeah.
He searched, he felt inside the tent everywhere.
Yeah.
The camel wasn't inside the tent. The camel sits outside the tent.
So, right, so the answer I would give is that it could be that the camel pillow is something portable. In other words, you leave it on the camel when you're riding, and then you take it off when you're not, and she's using it as a cushion for herself. And she uses that pillow specifically because that's going to be a large pillow.
Okay.
You know, that's what I would assume.
The rabbis were straining to make sure that she was a positive person. She was a positive.
Well, that's the thing. What the picture that emerges between these two midrashim, what we saw in number 8 and what we see now in number 9, is that Rachel is doing this with the highest of motives, and she has divine approval. She's doing it because she doesn't want her father to worship idols, and God puts his stamp on it and says, I'm going to save you from any embarrassment. However, we now have to come back to the question we asked in the beginning, which is, yeah, but it's theft. What do you do with theft and deception? And take a look at the last midrash. This picks up on Jacob's words, his loaded words that he said to Laban, when he said, with whomsoever you find your gods, he will not live. Says the midrash, lo yechyeh shall not live, vahava kein. And so it was, kishkaga hayotzam milifnei ashalit, like the error that goes forth from before the ruler, which is a verse in Ecclesiastes in Kohelet, to refer to when a ruler says something, bless you, when a ruler issues a decree, by mistake, it doesn't matter, everybody still has to obey. And Jacob said, not knowing that Rachel had them, whoever has them is going to die. And as a result, we are told, Vatignov Rachel and Rachel stole, Vatamad Rachel and Rachel died, because we know that when they come back into the land, she dies in childbirth, right? While producing the last son, Benjamin. And why does she die early? Says the Midrash, Jacob said, whoever has the trophim is going to die. And the message that I get from this is indeed that theft is always wrong. To go back to Ronit's question from yesterday, right, where she said, you're stealing from a thief, it's still theft, as the Talmud itself says. The reality is that it is wrong to do, and so the verse is picking up on the fact that this was what Jacob said, this was his own wording, and she died young, unlike any other patriarch or matriarch. Meaning everybody else in the family lives to a ripe old age. She's the only one who doesn't. So something must have happened. What happened? So you could answer, you know, mortality in childbirth in those days was quite common. And you could read it and say, this was something they were very familiar with and it happened to her. But the text is looking at it and saying, there's something else going on here. Jacob said, whoever has them is going to die. And so it happens. Yes, Miriam.
Yeah, when they're talking about Nubian creatures, is there any mention of Rachel not seeing that something divine is happening there?
This story ends there. We don't know anything further about what happens. It's a good question. We don't have any further reference to the Trephim.
She knows what you put there.
Yes. I know, but the story simply stops there. Yeah, we don't know. Yes.
Jacob, he's a person.
Yeah.
So any person says, and you should have done that, you'll die, that's a decree that's going to come true.
So I will tell you two things. Yes, a very good question. Does that mean that anybody's speech has such power? So I will tell you two things. First of all, Jacob isn't just anybody, right? He is of the line of the patriarchs. That's number one. But number two, that is absolutely a very... what's what I'm looking for? Not common. I'll say common. It is a common theme in much of Judaism that, yes, that which a person says is taken, number one, as binding as law, and number two, can have very negative consequences. When you think of the Torah in the beginning of the Parsha of Matot, when it says that a person can create law, if a person takes a vow and says, I will do X, I won't do X, it is as binding as any mitzvah in the Torah upon them. When the Torah says, Motzas Batecha Tishmor, you shall guard that which your mouth produces, you bet. And it continues down till today, when people have the practice of not wanting to talk about their good fortune, for example, or not wanting to word something in a negative way. In the Talmud, when somebody wants to describe God harming the Jews in some way, he says, harming our enemies. You find that consistently. In the Torah, you find it even with non-Jews saying it. So one example of that is Pharaoh, when he says the Jews are going to multiply, right? And then there's going to be a war. They will fight against us and leave the land. But in fact, the commentators say, he doesn't mean that the Jews are going to leave the land. He means they're going to force us out of the land. He just doesn't want to say so. You find it repeatedly as a theme in Jewish history that, yes, speech has power. That speech can be significant. It's a scary idea, but yes, that is in fact the idea. So what I want to show you, just to wrap up, is these midrashim have provided insight into how we look at Rachel. We have here this small story, which really, in the context of Jacob and his family fleeing from Laban, can easily get overlooked, and I think it often is overlooked. But it fits into the broader scheme of deception and theft that happens within the family, and it has a message for us. And the message that it has is Rachel has pure intentions. We say she took the trophim of her father because she wanted her father not to have them. She's trying to wean him from idolatry, just like Abraham tries to wean Terach. And
why did she blame it or whatever, like him?
She has to get out of Dodge. That would be my answer. They just left the house. They're running. They're 3 days out and they've been moving nonstop. There hasn't been an opportunity. God honors her attempt, just like he acted for Sarah, just like he acted for Rebecca. So too, he was going to. He didn't end up doing it because they got caught before the deception was complete. But he acted for Sarah twice. He's going to act for her as well to protect her because her intentions are good. But in the end, it comes back to bite her.
I'm just wondering, why would God, if she had to run, why would God have less influence on what results?
I don't know that it's about superseding what God has said. I think that God also has an interest in making sure that people don't steal. In other words, yes, you meant well, and I'm going to save you from Laban. But long term, there's going to be a penalty for having done this. That's not strange. I'll give you another example of it. Right? Jacob deceived his father and got the blessings. Right? What happens to Jacob in the end? He is deceived regarding to the sale of Joseph. Judah When they deceived their father, this is one of the great themes that you find in Bereshit, in this book of Genesis. The brothers say to the father, here is the cloak that they had dipped in blood, right? And they say to him, Hakerna, recognize please, or recognize now, depending on how you translate the word na. When Tamar wants to tell Judah who she is, when after this whole thing between them happens, she sends him his cloak. And she says, Haker na, recognize it now. Not that she knows what words they used with Jacob, but the text is giving us this and saying the words fall into her mouth. The same words that were used before when they did their deception are going to come back to him. Now, yeah, no, in a very substantive way. And it happens over and over again, especially in that book, where what one does, even with good intentions, ends up coming back to harm him. Shayna, and then we'll turn it over to Shayna for the second one.
My favorite example,
Shayna and Nancy, yeah.
My favorite example, the one that was mentioned today, although not in that context, which is after Yaakov and his mother have combined to get him what belonged to his older brother, what happens? He goes to marry a younger sister and he's duped. And the reply that he objects is, we don't give precedence to the younger over the elder.
Right.
Not our custom.
Right. We don't do what you did. Very good. Thank you. Yes, and Nancy.
I have a question about Midrash. Is there a Midrash implicating Rachel being involved in the deception of the switch of the sisters?
Yes, and that's actually where we're going. That's actually where we're going next week, an ideal segue, as we talk about who is and is not blamed for the switching of Leah and Rachel. So that was an ideal segue. Come back on Wednesday. Thank you.